Hello there, and welcome to Happy Place, the show that gets under the skin of some truly inspirational people and see what helps them unwind, refresh, and just stay in a good place, really. I'm Fern Cotton, and today we travel back to Manchester for the second chat we recorded at the Happy Place Festival last month. And this week, it's with the founding leader of the Women's Equality Party, a brilliant mate of mine and all-round good egg, Sophie Walker.
I think once you tune into your anger and channel it, it tells you a lot. It is communicating stuff to you, and you have to listen.
Now, if you've never heard of Sophie before, this is a great place to start. Get ready. She is incredible. In 2018, Vogue named her a new suffragette for her work promoting a modern and what she calls hopeful feminism.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And now it's showtime. Hi, Sophie.
Hello.
Sophie, meet the crowd,
Wow.
Meet Sophie.
Hello.
So, Sophie, I met you a little while ago now.
Yes.
Basically, randomly, we were put together to do an interview for some initiative that was happening. And I got to sit and quiz you about lots of different things. And instantly, I was like, who is this amazing human? Everything you said made me kind of really sit up and listen and think about things differently, and I've been creepily following what you've been doing ever since.
Well, likewise.
So at the time you were leader of the Women's Equality Party.
I was, yes.
And you were there since the conception of that party.
Yep.
How on earth do you start a new political party with a manifesto and get it off the ground?
By having absolutely no idea the size of the task that you have set yourself, basically. So I never intended to do politics. Right? My parents, I grew up in Glasgow in the 70s, and my mum and dad were very active. We went on a lot of marches. They were sort of northern working class. Like, if there's something that's wrong, you stand up and you shout about it. And I did so many marches. We marched for CND, we marched for the miners' strike, we raised money for the miners' wives. It was, by the end of it, I was like, okay, if politics is all that marching, I don't really want to do politics. So I became a journalist. I thought, I'm interested in the world and I'm interested in telling stories. And it was a really interesting process being a journalist. I was in a very, very male environment. There was a lot of testosterone. I was covering politics and I was covering trade and I was covering the economy and stock markets, and basically everybody's motivation seemed to revolve around either fear or greed. And I spent a lot of the time feeling really intimidated, actually. And you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people in this room are familiar with imposter syndrome, right?
Yeah.
I spent 20 years at work feeling like I was going to be found out, and it was exhausting. And then I had a child, and that was the point where, as a woman, I really understood that everything that we've been told is a lie. I mean, I don't think it has to be having children that radicalises women, but I think for a lot of us it really does. And I would be, you know, sort of struggling to balance work and home. And then my daughter was diagnosed with autism, which was a long and really painful process. And at that point, I was like a single mum. I was trying to pay the rent. I was trying to get my daughter the support she needed. I was surrounded by all these sort of men at work who were like, yeah, like, I've got 20 kids. What's the problem?
And I'd easy. Like, yeah. So easy.
And I'd have these sort of to-do lists in Byron up both arms. Like, by the time I got to work, and I was exhausted and I was stressed, and I just thought, you know what, this is rubbish, and it's not true, and it's not fair. And I became really motivated to become an activist. I understood finally that nobody was coming to the rescue, actually. Mm. And it was on me. And so, you know, when I heard that there was a new political party coming into being, I was really excited by that, because I thought, I'm really tired of all the other political parties expecting me to vote for them and wait in line.
Yeah.
Right? Like, feminism and women's equality is something that we give out in little bits around election time. You know, and have you ever heard, like, whenever politicians talk about women's equality, it's like this really hard thing.
Mm.
Right? Like, it's like they all start sort of stroking their chins. And it's going to take at least 100 years.
Yeah, more. Another 100 years.
I think, like, we're going to have to run some more focus groups.
God.
And I just thought, you know, save my unfeminist language, but I just thought that was bollocks.
Yeah.
And I was really tired of, you know, because these same people were like, you know, we'll get back to you when we've sorted out Brexit. Which is a feminist issue, but we'll come to that later on. Mm. So I just thought, right, so this thing was happening, and I said, yes, I'm in. What can I do? And I thought I was going to be putting out chairs.
Oh, no. They had greater plans for you, Sophie Walker.
Well, it was, I mean, so I went along to the first meeting, and one of the co-founders, Catherine Mayer, said to me, why don't you come and talk? And I said, like, I don't, like, about what? And she said, well, come and talk about care, childcare. And I said, like, and this was like a running joke, because as many of you who are, like, people who know me know that, like, I have a pub rant about childcare. I don't really do a talk about childcare. I sort of, like, steam comes out of my ears. And I, so we went along and we did this thing, and I talked about childcare, and actually suddenly I realised I'd found my people. I was in a room full of other predominantly women going, yes!
Yeah.
Like, care really matters.
Yeah.
Like, we rely on women to do it for free or badly paid. We don't give them a choice. We tell them that it's, you know, it's our inner nature as women to be caring. Mm. So, like, you know, and none of us, you know, the rest of us don't, and when I say us, I mean the predominantly male decision makers. Mm. They're like, yeah, but ladies, you're so good at caring.
Mm.
So why don't you just go and do it for free?
Mm.
And then we'll get on with sorting out whatever the more important
not
things are.
Not sorting out stuff.
Yeah.
Do you think because we hear the word feminism being battered around so much more than, say, 50 years ago, that culturally we sort of have been forced to believe that it's getting better. There's less disparity. We now live in some sort of egalitarian society, whereas, of course, we don't. Mm. And there are lots of hidden ways that women get pushed to the sidelines that we might not even be aware of. Can you talk us through some of the more obvious ways that it massively affects everybody in society, men and women, and also the sort of the ways that are slightly more hidden and covered up so that we don't notice?
Sure. Well, I mean, so first of all, I think, like, the way that we talk about feminism is really interesting because, you know, there's been a concerted effort for decades to convey feminism as something stupid and done mainly by slightly mad women, sort of slightly swivel-eyed and hairy. And it was deliberate. It was a very deliberate thing. Like, if we can rebrand this as something that no reasonable person is going to want to do or be part of, then that's half of the problem solved, and we won't have to deal with this rising movement of women demanding equality. Mm. I found it really heartening in recent years that there's been this big, I think, revival of activism broadly, but feminist activism particularly. And I think that's been massively helped by Donald Trump. I'd just like to say a big thank you to Donald Trump.
He recruits your fans.
Yeah, he's for the Women's Equality Party, and indeed for many, many women's organisations. I'm now at the Young Women's Trust. He is our number one recruitment agency, so thanks for that, Donald.
Keep being an asshole.
Yes.
And things are good.
Yes. So he demonstrated that sexism and misogyny and that sort of hate, the power of dividing people and setting them at odds with each other and making them frightened and hateful, is the number one gambit of politicians who haven't got any new ideas. And I think in that context, feminism was able to be understood as something that was really necessary and actually very straightforward, that it's just about equality. And the other thing, and I love that you've brought this up, is because it's always introduced as, but haven't you got enough equality? You know, who really needs feminism? Like, look at you all. I mean, you're all fine. And I think that this is a deflection tactic. We are not fine. 2/3 of Britain's poorest people are women.
Yeah.
You know, women are earning less. They have smaller pensions. They are more likely to be not in work. There is an epidemic of violence against women and girls. Like, women are not doing okay, and that's from, you know, every possible measure. So when you look at representation, for example, when you look at Parliament, men outnumber women by 2-1. When you look at local government, men outnumber women by 2-1. When you look at the FTSE 100, there are six CEOs now who are women in the FTSE 100, which means that female CEOs in the FTSE are not only outnumbered by men, they are outnumbered by men called Dave. Oh no, Steve.
Steve.
Steve or Dave, Steve. Can't remember. Well, one of those.
But isn't it funny, because even when we talk about it, and this has become a subconscious thing for many of us, if we talk about, say, even a film director, if it's a female, we'll go, a female director.
Yes.
Well, you'd never say a male director.
Yes.
It's kind of like seen as, oh, isn't that good that we've got a female in there?
Well,
it's become abnormal, so then we sort of overly celebrate it.
Well, I think, and this is something that, you know, is a key part of representation, is that we are operating from, in business and in politics and in arts and culture, in society, on the basis that the default template is male. Mm. It's the male experience. That women are sort of not men. And that is why we have to sort of specify that so-and-so is a woman. And the really dangerous part of that is that decision-making is being made by a small group of people who all look and sound alike. And it is predominantly white men, straight, middle class, non-disabled Steves. Right. Sorry if there's anybody in here called Steve.
We love you if you're called Steve. Here,
if you're here, if you're here and you're called Steve, we really love you. Thank you for coming. But it's a serious problem, because what is happening is that decisions are being made about women's lives by men who don't understand that women's lives are different, and that the female experience is different, and that we are operating within structures that tell us from birth that we are, because that we are not men, that we are second class, that we are, you know, I'm now chief executive for the Young Women's Trust.
Yes.
Absolutely brilliant organisation. And what we do is that we campaign for economic justice for young women, because young women in this country are being pushed through an education system that says you're not as good as men, you're not as good as boys. Like, because you don't have a penis, you can't do science. You know, you are ladies, and you are, again, you're pink and you're sparkly, and you, there's nothing wrong with sparkly, and there's lots of sparkly people in here today, but that sort of, you know, you'll do arts, and you'll do caring work and clerical work and the soft stuff, and the men are leaders. And I know it sounds simplistic, but it is still absolutely entrenched in our education system, of this thing called occupational segregation, which is funneling girls and boys out into different jobs, and funneling boys into jobs that we care about more and that we value more and that we pay better, is massive. And as a result, we have we have a real issue in this country. We have like more than a million girls between the ages of young women between the ages of 18 and 30 are in no pay or on no pay or in low paid work. More than a million of them are being paid less than their male colleagues for same or similar work. More than 800,000 of them are experiencing sexual harassment at work and are too frightened to say anything about it. It is a huge problem. But I, you know, I'm about the optimism, right? I mean, I went through a horrific time, you know, trying to work out what I needed for me and my daughter. And the thing that I've learned from that is there is nothing lonelier than waiting for somebody else to ride to the rescue.
Yeah.
And that collective action, finding your people, finding your sisters,
yes,
is just the best thing in the world. And it is also the most effective thing in the world.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, that's what I am desperate to get onto now, because you stepped down as leader of the party because you feel so passionately about activism. That is something that we haven't covered on this podcast at all. I don't necessarily hear it getting chatted about as a subject that much. We hear about what the activism is, but actually just activism as something that any of us in this tent could do. And it's probably something that not a lot of us have thought about. And I'm sure that everybody here today classes themselves as a caring, passionate person who likes other people and wants to be helpful, but I don't think many of us would think that we could do activism. It feels like something that other people might do. Why is that? How are you trying to reframe it and get people to know they can be part of something?
Well, I mean, so first of all, I stood down for the Women's Equality Party because for me the power of leadership is about giving that power to other people. It's about passing the mic. It's about making sure that different voices, different perspectives can be heard.
I don't think many people do that in politics, Sophie, do they normally?
Well, I really didn't
want to
be...
You're a rare breed.
I didn't want to be the Nigel Farage of the Women's Equality Party.
Thank God.
Because, like, that is... That's about ego, not system change.
Yes.
And I'm about system change.
Yes.
And so now the Women's Equality Party is being led by the fantastic Mandu Reid. It is the only party being led by a black woman. She's brilliant. Look her up. Follow her. She's fab. To come back to the activism stuff, what I wanted to do was to explore sustainable activism. Because, you know, becoming a public figure, as you know better than anybody, can often be quite a bruising experience.
Yeah.
Like you're really put out there. Becoming an activist and being political means talking a lot about it often comes from the personal stuff, like the stuff that has propelled you into wanting to change something, either for yourself or for people you love or for people you know. And we live in an environment where the public debate has never been more aggressive. It has never been more combative. And many of the social media platforms that were set up ostensibly to facilitate discussion have actually, I think, very cynically been about packaging us all as individuals in order to sell stuff to us. So all this stuff about, you know, go on, you know, let's start a conversation, let's open up the world to everybody. I'm not convinced that's what's happening. I think we're being compartmentalised and packaged into more and more extreme versions of ourselves and then set in this gladiatorial arena to just, like, slug it out. And that, that doesn't achieve anything. And so, I felt very... there were some wonderful, wonderful high points. I've been an activist now for 10 years, but there's been some real low points, and there's been some points where I have really despaired at the scale of the job. You know, when you look at the scale of the inequalities in the world, like 1% of the world's population hold half the world's wealth, right? We know again and again, surveys show us how disappointed people are in politicians. We had one from Young Women's Trust just this week showing that two-thirds of young women between 18 and 30 have given up on politicians. They've just, like, their confidence has plummeted. So I've been writing this book, which is about how we can be activists sustainably. And it's a bit of a sort of philosophical journey. If I'm honest, it's the book I sort of wish I could have read.
Yeah.
Because you're right, activism, you know, some interviewing people for it was really interesting. I had some people say, well, you know, I would never call myself an activist. To me, an activist is, those amazing lesbian women who abseiled down the side of the House of Parliament to protest against, you know, Section 28. People have ideas of an activist as somebody who sort of climbs aboard an oil tanker on the behalf of Greenpeace, and it's this like huge thing. And if that's what you want to do, that's great.
Yeah.
But actually, activism is for me is having a big visionary idea of how you want the world to be and acting day to day in sustainable, manageable ways to make it happen.
Because I'm sure everybody here will have a cause, like you say, that is from a personal situation, something that they've experienced firsthand or within their family or community, and they feel like they would like to strike out, they would like to see change, yes. They would like to be part of something. But like you've touched on a few times, a lot of the times these problems seem too big, and we think, well, what could I do? If I do something every day, that's not going to do anything. You know, even when we vote now, we don't feel like that's even doing anything to create change. So how can we rely on the sort of model of activism to do something and to create good change?
Well, the first thing you have to do is defeat despair. The powers that be are relying on you to feel that it's all too much. Mm. They are relying on you to feel, what can I do?
Yeah.
Because that way, their actions go unchallenged. So the very, very first thing you have to do is say, I am not going to let this sense of despair get to me. And one of my favourite quotes on this is George Eliot, who talked about, who said, often what we call our despair is actually hope. It's the disappointment of unfulfilled hope.
Well, that's amazing.
So if you're feeling despair, that's actually something to be encouraged by, because it means that you want something better, and you have to hang on to that bit, because that will start to get you out of it.
Because what are the repercussions of us not doing something?
Well, precisely nothing.
Nothing. All of the huge corporations, CEOs, whatever, carrying on doing whatever they want to do that's perhaps disrupting what we are passionate about, love, and care about.
Exactly. But I also think that, you know, it's a very common reaction to feel despair and to just think, I'm just going to get my head down and get through this. Mm. But, you know, the people who are on the other side of this, they're not going to rest. You know, they're busy while you're doing nothing. They're really busy. Mm. So the first thing you have to do is you have to defeat your despair. The second thing you have to do, and because when you decide to re-engage with the world and start to look at some of the stuff that's been bothering you, you will start to feel really angry.
So angry.
Really, really
angry. I'm quite an angry person. Like, you might not assume that, but I've got a lot of anger in me.
Well,
I've got loads of it.
Well, that's good.
No, it is good.
It's a really, because the other thing is that as women, we are often told that we shouldn't be angry. And particularly if you're a feminist, right? It's the classic stereotype. Ooh, you're a bit angry, aren't you?
Yeah, I bloody am.
And but that's great, because I think once you tune into your anger and channel it, it tells you a lot. Mm. It is communicating stuff to you, and you have to listen. And if the people around you don't like it, then what you can understand from that is that it's working.
So
it's
anger working. Doesn't have to be aggression. Anger is passion. It's how you channel it, as you're saying.
Exactly.
It's not like you standing there giving abuse to the people you don't agree with. It's you working out practical change and channeling that can be a really tough emotion, anger, but channeling it to do some good.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It can be really hard because it will force you to go back to the stuff that's been bothering you, yeah, that you've been trying not to look at. And some of that stuff, it can be very difficult, mm, and it can be upsetting, and you may need some help to come to terms with what's happened to you in some circumstances. But it's absolutely about reconnecting yourself to, yeah, to that feeling and that whatever it is that allows you to come out of it and through it, and that eventually allows you to become hopeful.
Yes.
And then so the next bit is hope. I mean, hope. Mm. I love talking about hope because it is the one thing that nobody can ever take away from you.
Yeah.
And there's this a wonderful writer called Rebecca Solnit, who wrote a book called Hope in the Dark, which you can order when you're buying mine.
There you go.
Things.
The full name of the book, which is Five Rules for Rebellion. Let's change the world ourselves.
Yes. Thank you. So also Rebecca Solnit wrote this great book called Hope in the Dark, and she talks about hope in the most wonderful terms. She says, hope is not a lottery ticket that you sit on the sofa clutching. It is an axe that you use to break down the door in case of emergency. And I absolutely love that. And I think that I have always found that being optimistic is not only, I mean, it's something you have to work at, right? Hope requires that you get out of bed every morning and you reset your determination to be hopeful. It is work, and it's hard work. But when you are armed with hope, nobody can take that away from you. And also, it's really intimidating.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when I say I'm a feminist, you get the sort of, oh, feminist. And when you say I'm an optimistic feminist, they're like, oh, shit. So, hope.
Okay, two things to say on that. First, it's really nice to hear of hope talked about and not always, and not in a religious sense, because I think in a sort of archaic way, we always think you have to be religious to have faith or hope. But you're saying it's a discipline.
Yeah.
It's to motivate you to get out of bed and to think of the best possible outcome, which then gives you the impetus to go in that direction.
Yeah.
And the second thing, just a side thought from what you just said, why do we still sometimes people have that reaction of, or if someone goes, are you a feminist? People go, oh, I don't know, I think I am. And it's just quite simple. It's like, do you want women to be equal to men? Yeah. Why are we so scared of saying it still?
Well, I as I said, I think increasingly women aren't, and I find huge joy from that, because I think calling yourself a feminist is about taking up space. And the more of us that take up space, the more we get done. Because the next key point of this is about collaboration. It is about compassion for each other and collaboration. Because essentially, what activism is trust and love. It is trust that you can change the world, and it is love for all of your sisters who are doing it with you.
Yeah. Because Sophie very kindly interviewed me for her new book. And at first I had the reaction, like you said, many other contributors have, like, I don't think I'm an activist. Do I do activism? And then when we sat down to talk, I thought, oh, maybe I am sort of doing that. Mm. And again, mine was from personal experience, having a really crappy time and feeling very desperate and like I didn't fit into anything that I was currently in. Mm. And getting on to collaboration and a collective of people that also have the same vision and hope, I've sort of done that by accident. But look, we're all sat here now. You know, we are this collective and we are a gang that want to talk about well-being and mental health and things that we're passionate about and to be communicative and open.
Yeah.
And I feel really lucky that I sort of stumbled into that because I very fortunately had an audience that sort of knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I've managed to bring some of them over to go, let's look over here instead of over here. But if you are starting from the ground up with a passion, with a cause and with hope, how do you begin to create that gang and that movement where you do feel more powerful in numbers?
Well, this is where you have to find your people, right? I think and it's interesting. I think activism has become a bit trendy, and I think that increasingly people like to call themselves an activist. But I think that that activism is not something you can do on your own. I think you have to be prepared to collaborate, and that means you have to be prepared to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. Mm. I've seen so many really brilliant ideas fail to happen because the person who had it couldn't bring themselves to share it or hold it up to the light to be looked at by other people. And it's a really uncomfortable thing to do because other people have got different opinions.
How do you get brave with that one? How do you get the courage
practice,
to do that?
Practice. It's hard. And I speak as someone who has been through that.
I'm sure.
I've been through that sort of, I don't really want to talk to anybody about this because then they'll tell me it's a bit rubbish. And part of that is a confidence thing. We are, you know, as women, we are told by society that we're, you know, of less worth and of less value. And there is a massive crisis in confidence among women that is, I think, something that is structural, that we have to really look at and start to understand the roots of it. But I think compassionate collaboration is vital, and I think your idea, I get through it by telling myself my idea gets better the more people comment on it, not worse. It's like shining a diamond. You know, the more people that can push it this way or that, or shine it up this way or that, by adding their perspectives and their thoughts and their contributions, the bigger and better this thing gets.
And it is
hard, you know, as I said, you know, the personal is political, and to disagree with people on matters that really matter to you can be painful, you know, and I I'm very conscious that particularly in the women's movement that, you know, at the time at which you want to be all pulling together, quite often there are internal splits and rows, and that is really difficult. But you know, activism is not therapy. Like, we should all be doing therapy. I'm a big advocate of therapy.
Mm-hmm, same.
But activism is not therapy. Activism requires robust and respectful debate, so that we can embrace and acknowledge our difference, and then also find our common ground, because it's from that we all find our communal strength.
And we often, if we don't agree with another group of people, we won't even look to find that common ground. We just go for the jugular of what are the differences and how can we beat them. I guess there's layers of confidence that are needed, because like you've said, you've got that initial moment of having an idea and feeling courageous enough to say, this is my idea, will you join me?
Yeah.
But then there's that bit about you're in the thick of it, you're out there, you're talking to people, you are perhaps rubbing other people up the wrong way and getting a negative reaction. How do you personally sit in that discomfort of knowing that other people are saying, I don't agree with you and I never ever will? How do you remain hopeful and also just sit in that? Because it is a personal discomfort for me to deal with that.
For me, the key thing that I look for is whether that other person is engaging in good faith.
Right.
Right. If they're not engaging in good faith, I'm out. It's a total waste of my passion and my energy and my love.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I do this out of a sense of love for other people. I'm hugely inspired and guided by particularly other women. I find that the energy and the creativity of women is an endless source of hope and joy for me. And that's what I want to hang on to. So, you know, if I tweet stuff, and like Twitter's a cesspit, but it's also the kind of place where you can connect with people, even if it's very difficult to have a conversation because like everybody's watching and there's loads of people just want to kill it.
Yeah.
So I've stopped trying to engage with people on the grounds that I might eventually persuade them if it's clear to me that it's a waste of my energy. But then there will be people who do want to, you know, they are going to ask you difficult questions and they are going to want to. But I think you the more you do it, the better you get a sense of who's actually in this to come with me and needs and wants a bit of persuading. Who can I learn from? You know, I don't go into these engagements with a sense of I'm going to sort of beat them over the head until they agree. It's like, you know, what can I learn here too?
I love, even with the title of your book, that you're sort of reframing the word rebel, because we see the word rebel as being synonymous with someone who's done something bad, someone who's rebelling against a perfectly fine system, and they're a bit scary, whereas you're using rebellion in a very positive way.
Yes.
What does it mean to you?
Yeah, how much longer have we got?
We can fit it in, I think. We can do that in 13 minutes.
Rebellion to me means freedom. It's freedom. And it's freedom particularly for women and girls. Mm. It's freedom from... I mean, it's freedom from all of it, all of it. It's freedom from being told to cheer up because your face isn't, like, placatory at all times.
I hate that one.
You know...
If someone says to me, smile, love, I can literally feel my toes gripping to the soles of my shoes. It is... Yeah. I can't bear it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the pit.
It's you know, it's freedom from fear.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, this is a big, big thing, right? Like, we, as women, we curtail our behaviour out of fear in hundreds of ways every day that we might not actually be aware of. Mm. Whether it's what we wear, or whether it's how we move, or the areas in which we move, how we talk, the words we use.
Yeah, language is very powerful with this one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very
really
powerful.
Is. It really is.
Do you think there's probably quite a lot of people sat here right now who are already partaking in activism, but they haven't actually realised it?
Yes, undoubtedly.
Mm, that's a good
well
thought.
Well done.
That's a really good thought. And I'm wondering, sort of looking out to the crowd now, after listening to Sophie so brilliantly talk about this, who's feeling even more ramped up to go down a road they might have already been tinkering with in their heads? Yeah? Sing
oh,
some
come
hands
on,
up.
A few more.
Yeah.
Excellent.
It's exciting. It's an exciting thought, isn't it? Because that's what... I've been lucky enough to have a sneaky read of Sophie's book. And I... And it is that fire in your belly. And that's exciting. That, to me, is always when I feel most alive. When I've got fire and passion in my belly. And I do feel ready for other people's comments if they don't agree. And I feel ready to bring more people on board and to feel like part of something. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Rather than being... Because, you know, one of the things that is exasperating... loneliness or feeling very individual is, of course, our phones and social media and how that is culturally presented to us.
Yes.
But we can use that to be part of something, and that is so wonderful, rather than they're doing this and I'm not, they look like that and I don't, or whatever. This is like being part of something which is bigger than all that crap.
Yeah, I'm so, so glad that you brought that up, because, like, that... What I really, really wanted to say, as on top of all the other stuff I really wanted to say, was that persevering is about keeping your eyes on the prize and not allowing yourself to be sucked in by all of those messages that the thing you need to fix first is yourself. And I think that is, it's so in our faces with everything. If you consider what our experience is as women, right? So we start off being told that as girls we should be pretty, and we should be quiet, and we should be well behaved, and then we should go to school that we should be do really well in all of our subjects, while also maintaining a size 8 or whatever, and be real BFFs, have loads of BFFs.
Oh, loads.
I really want to kill the whole BFF thing. I hate it.
Socialise loads.
We socialise loads, get loads of straight A's, and then we all go to work, and somehow we're being paid less by them than the men. And I'm like, okay, so try harder. So okay, so then we start doing all the training on how to be the best we can be.
My best life.
I hate that one. Yes. And then if you didn't get a pay rise, it's because you didn't ask right. So then you do the training on how to ask properly. And then you do the training on resilience training to bear up better under the strain of being female in the workplace. And then you're like feeling a bit stressed about being, you know, not good enough as a female in the workplace. And so then you take up whatever it is that you're being told will make you better, and so we're all doing baking, and we're all doing yoga, and we're all, and like, and we're running, we're taking up macrame, we're looking at we're told, like, are you having good sex? So then you're like, are you trying to have really good sex as well as baking and running?
I'm steaming my vagina with kombucha.
Yeah, and getting your promotion and your pay rise. Yeah. And we end up with, like, generations of knackered women.
Yeah, and exhausted.
So what I want to say to you, ladies, is that
your liberation is in each other.
Yes. Oh, I'm going to clip that rant and have it on my phone at all times. Wow. Please, can you give a huge round of applause to Sophie Walker? Oh, I don't know about you, but I feel pumped, energised, va-va-voomed. I mean, this is what I feel like every time I'm in Sophie's presence. Just sort of invigorated and ready for action, and like all of my passions are unearthed once again. And I just know that I need to, you know, channel that energy and do more good and be part of a community. I feel just massively inspired yet again by listening to the wonderful Sophie. What a way to start the week. Sophie Walker, thank you. Now, if you liked it too, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps people find the show and pushes it up the charts. And do hit subscribe to get next week's episode direct to your phone as soon as it drops. You'll be glad you did, as it means you'll get to hear from author Catherine Gray.
You learn to have a drink when you go to a party. That's what you do to calm down. Or you preload before the party.
Yeah.
That's what I used to do.
Yeah, same.
So you just don't really go into social situations where there's lots of people where you're not a little bit buzzed. So you don't know how to do it, I think. Mm. And it becomes a crutch.
Get that wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Entail. I mean, literally everywhere. Thanks again to the brilliant Sophie, to the wonderful audience at the Happy Place Festival, the producers Matt Hill, Thomas Griffin and Sarah Miles at Rethink Audio, and to you, gorgeous lot, for listening. Honestly, really means a lot. Thank you so much. See you next week.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.